Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining me today for Readings of Interest to the Jewish Community. My name is Michael Wolin. I'm going to start with a parsha, a dual parsha this week, Achare Mot and Kedoshim, double portion. And the commentary that I'm going to pass along to you is by Rabbi Yonatan Sacks, and he's titled this, The Courage to Admit Mistakes. There's something every week in the Torah portion that's useful, personal relations, in living every day, going about your business, just doing things. And this is one of them. The courage to admit mistakes. Some years ago, I was visited by the then American ambassador to the court of St. James, Philip Lader. He told me of a fascinating project he and his wife had initiated in 1981. They'd come to realize that many of their contemporaries would find themselves in positions of influence and power in the not-too-distant future. He thought it would be useful and creative if they were to come together for a study retreat every so often to share ideas, to listen to experts, and to form friendships, thinking through collectively the challenges they would face in the coming years. So they created what they called Renaissance Weekends, and they still happen. The most interesting thing he told me was that they discovered that the participants, all exceptionally gifted people, found one thing particularly difficult, and that is admitting that they had made mistakes. The Laders understood that this was something important they had to learn. Leaders, above all, should be capable of acknowledging when and how they had erred, and how to put it right. They came up with a brilliant idea. They set aside a session at each weekend for a talk given by a recognized star in some field on the subject of my biggest blooper. Being English, not American, I had to ask for a translation. I discovered that a blooper is an embarrassing mistake, a gaffe, a faux pas, a bungle, a boo-boo, a fashla, a balagan, something you shouldn't have done and are ashamed to admit that you did it. This, in essence, is what Yom Kippur is in Judaism. In tabernacle and temple times, it was the day when the holiest man in Israel, the high priest, made atonement. First for his own sins, then for the sins of his house, then for the sins of all Israel. From the day the temple was destroyed, we have had no high priest nor the rites he performed, but we still have the day and the ability to confess and pray for forgiveness. It is so much easier to admit your sins, failings, and mistakes when other people are doing the same. If a high priest or other members of our congregation can admit to sins, then so can we. I have argued elsewhere, for example, in the introduction to the Koran Yom Kippur Machzor, that the move from the first Yom Kippur to the second was one of the great transitions in Jewish spirituality. The first Yom Kippur was the culmination of Moshe's effort to secure forgiveness for the people after the sin of the golden calf. This is found in the book of Exodus, chapter 32 through 34. The process, which began on the 17th of Tammuz, ended on the 10th of Tishrei. The day that later became Yom Kippur. That was the day when Moses descended the mountain with the second set of tablets, the visible sign that God had reaffirmed his covenant with the people. The second Yom Kippur, one year later, initiated the series of rites set out in this week's Parsha. This is in Leviticus chapter 16, conducted in the Mishkan by Aaron in his role as high priest. The difference between the two were immense. Moshe acted as a prophet. Aaron functioned as a priest. Moses was following his heart and his mind, improvising in response to God's response to his words. Aaron was following a precisely choreographed ritual, every detail of which was set out in advance. Moshe's encounter was ad hoc, a unique, unrepeatable drama between heaven and earth. Aaron's was the opposite. The rules he was following never changed throughout the generations, so long as the temple stood. Moses' prayers on behalf of the people were full of audacity, what the sages called chutzpah kelapai shamaya, audacity towards heaven, reaching a climax in the astonishing words, quote, "Now, please, forgive their sin, but if not, then blot me out of the book you have written." This is Exodus chapter 32, verse 32. Aaron's behavior, by contrast, was marked by obedience, humility, and confession. There were purification rituals, sin offerings, and atonements for his own sins and those of his house, as well as those of the people. The move from Yom Kippur 1 to Yom Kippur 2 was a classic instance of what Max Weber called the routinization of charisma. That is, taking a unique moment and translating it into a ritual, turning a peak experience into a regular part of life. Few moments in the Torah rival in intensity the dialogue between Moshe and God after the golden calf. But the question thereafter was, how could we achieve forgiveness? We, who no longer have a Moses or prophets or direct access to God. Great moments change history. But what changes us is the unspectacular habit of doing certain acts again and again until they reconfigure the brain and change our habits of the heart. We are shaped by the rituals we repeatedly perform. Besides which, Moshe's intercession with God did not, in and of itself, induce a penitential mood among the people. Yes, he performed a series of dramatic acts to demonstrate to the people their guilt, but we have no evidence that they internalized it. Aaron's acts were different. They involved confession, atonement, and a search for spiritual purification. They involved a candid acknowledgement of the sins and failures of the people, and they began with the high priest himself. The effect of Yom Kippur, extended into the prayers of much of the rest of the year by way of Tachanun, which is supplicatory prayers, Vidui, which is confession, and Selichot, prayers for forgiveness, was to create a culture in which people are not ashamed or embarrassed to say, "I got it wrong. I sinned. I made mistakes." That is what we do in the litany of wrongs we enumerate on Yom Kippur in two alphabetical lists, one beginning Ashamnu, Bagadnu, the other beginning Alchet Shechatanu. As Philip later discovered, the capacity to admit mistakes is anything but widespread. We rationalize. We justify. We deny. We blame others. There have been several powerful books on the subject in recent years, among them Matthew Syed, Black Box Thinking, The Surprising Truth About Success, and Why Some People Never Learn from Their Mistakes. Catherine Schultz, Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margins of Error, and Carol Tavris and Elliot Aronson, Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. Politicians find it hard, virtually impossible, to admit mistakes. So do doctors. Preventable medical error causes more than 400,000 deaths every year in the United States. So do bankers and economists find it hard to admit mistakes. The financial crash of 2008 was predicted by Warren Buffett as early as 2002. It happened despite the warnings of several experts that the level of mortgage lending and the leveraging of debt was unsustainable. Tavris and Aronson tell a similar story about the police. Once they have identified a suspect, they are reluctant to admit evidence of that person's innocence. And so it goes. The avoidance strategies are almost endless. People say it wasn't a mistake, or given the circumstances, it was the best that could have been done, or it was a small mistake, or it was unavoidable given what we knew at the time, or someone else was to blame. We were given the wrong facts. We were faultily advised. So people bluff it out or engage in denial or see themselves as victims. We have an almost infinite capacity for interpreting the facts to vindicate ourselves. As the sages said in the context of the laws of purity, no one can see his own blemishes, his own impurities. We are our own best advocates in the court of self-esteem. Rare is the individual with the courage to say, as the high priest did, or as King David did after the prophet Nathan confronted him with his guilt in relation to Uriah, his general, and Bathsheba. He said, Chatati, I have sinned. Judaism helps us admit our mistakes in three ways. First is the knowledge that God forgives. He does not ask us never to sin. He knew in advance that his gift of freedom would sometimes be misused. All he asks of us is that we acknowledge our mistakes, learn from them, confess, and resolve not to do them again. Second is Judaism's clear separation between the sinner and the sin. We can condemn the act without losing faith in the agent, the actor. Third is the aura, which Yom Kippur spreads over the rest of the year. It helps create a culture of honesty in which we are not ashamed to acknowledge the wrongs we have done. And, despite the fact that technically Yom Kippur is focused on sins between us and God, a simple reading of the confessions in Ashamnu and Al-Chet shows us that, actually, most of the sins we confess are about our dealings with other people. What Philip Lotter discovered about his high-flying contemporaries, Judaism internalized long ago. Seeing the best admit that they too make mistakes is deeply empowering for the rest of us. The first Jew to admit he made a mistake was Judah, who had wrongly accused Tamar of sexual misconduct, and then, realizing he had been wrong, he said, "She is more righteous than I." It is surely more than mere coincidence that the name Judah comes from the same root as vidui, confession. The Hebrew is Judah, pronounced like a Y, Judah. Same root as vidui, or confession. In other words, the very fact that we are called Jews, Yehudim, means we are the people who have the courage to admit our wrongs. Honest self-criticism is one of the unmistakable marks of spiritual greatness. It takes a great person to admit their mistakes, and petty people just can't do it. Well, there you go. That's Rabbi Yonatan Sacks, insightful commentary, as it always is. And he's commenting, of course, on Parsha Achrimot and Kedoshim, a joint, double Parsha, this week. And he talks about the courage to admit mistakes. Okay, well, I've got a really a porphyry of commentary for you this week. I want to read one about Leonardo da Vinci. I think I read this a couple of weeks ago, but interesting piece of commentary, I think. This is a story by Mark Weitzman. I found this in Tablet Magazine. About an Italian historian, his name is Carlo Vecchi, who set out to debunk rumors of Da Vinci's foreign origins. But what his research led him to changed his mind. And he said, "The most probable hypothesis, given what I found, is that Caterina was Jewish." Okay, Caterina is his mother. In all likelihood, Leonardo da Vinci was only half Italian. His mother, Caterina, was a Circassian Jew born somewhere in the Caucasus, abducted as a teenager and sold as a sex slave several times in Russia, Constantinople, and Venice, before finally being freed in Florence at the age of 15. At least this is the conclusion that reached in the new book, Il Sorriso di Caterina, Le Madre di Leonardo, by the historian Carlo Vecchi, one of the most distinguished specialists on Leonardo da Vinci. The official version of da Vinci's birth is that he was the fruit of a brief fling between the Florentine solicitor Piero da Vinci and a young peasant from Tuscany called Caterina, of whom almost nothing was known. Yet there had long been a seemingly unfounded theory that Leonardo had foreign origins and that Caterina was an Arab slave. 6 years ago, Professor Vecchi decided to kill the rumor for good. "I simply found it impossible to believe that the mother of the greatest Italian genius would be a non-Italian slave," he told me. "Now, not only do I believe it, but the most probable hypothesis, given what I found, is that Caterina was Jewish." And, of course, that would make Leonardo Jewish. Vecchi was the right man for the job. He published an anthology of da Vinci's writings and a biography, Leonardo, translated into several languages, and he collaborated on the exhibition of da Vinci's drawings and manuscripts at the Louvre and the Metropolitan Museum in 2003. He embarked on the research for his latest book during the reconstruction of da Vinci's library, which is where he found the document that changed everything. Dated November 2, 1452, 7 months after Leonardo's birth, and signed by Piero da Vinci in his professional capacity, it is an emancipation act regarding the daughter of a certain Jacob, originating from the Caucasian Mountains, and named Caterina. According to the document, Caterina's owner appears to have been the wife of a rich merchant, Donato de Filippo, who lived near the San Michele Visdomini Church in Florence, and whose usual solicitor for business was Piero da Vinci. The date on the document is underlined several times, as if da Vinci's hand was shaking as he proceeds to the liberation of the woman who just gave him a child. Slavery was still current practice in 15th century Italy, though on a much smaller scale than in the Ottoman Empire. The city of Florence alone had at least 1,000 slaves, among them Russians, Abkhazs, Turks, Serbs, and, like Caterina, Circassians from the Caucasus. Who was this woman who gave birth to one of the greatest geniuses of the Renaissance? Investigating her story, Professor Vecchi traced another part of the history of the Jews. Traveling from Russia, he told me, Caterina certainly passed through the Taman Peninsula near Crimea, which opens onto the Azov Sea. The peninsula owes its name to David of Taman, the king of the Jewish Khazar kingdom that briefly existed there during the 7th to the 10th centuries. It seems that some traces of the Khazar kingdom still existed in the 15th century, when the peninsula was controlled by the Genovese Jewish Gisolfi family. The region was ruled by Jewish consuls until the Ottoman Empire put an end to it at the end of the 15th century. Most of the slave ships traveled from the Venetian colony implanted at Azov, which was then called Tana, to Constantinople. From there we can follow Caterina to Venice, and then to Florence, where she was brought by her new master, Donato de Filippo, who put her to work both in his clothing workshop and at the service of his wife. That she was a sex slave is attested to by the fact that she already had several children by Filippo when, at 15, she met Da Vinci. Filippo's solicitor, who at first borrowed her as a nanny for his daughter, Marie, and then fell so much in love with her that he freed her from slavery after Leonardo's birth. Da Vinci himself was no stranger to the Jews, says Professor Vecchi. His main customers were among the Jewish community of Florence. Piero da Vinci ended up leaving Florence for Milan. Caterina died there in 1493. And is probably buried in the San Francesco Grande Church, where Leonardo had painted the Virgin della Roce a few years before. As for Donato de Filippo, after his death, he gave his money to the church of San Bartolomeo a Monte Oliveto, for which Leonardo would paint the Annunciation. Coincidentally enough, the background of this painting shows a mountain very similar to Mount Elbrus, the highest summit of the Caucasus Mountains. An oriental port quite similar to the port Caterina passed through when she was a slave also figures on the painting. According to Professor Vecchi, Caterina certainly fed young Leonardo's imagination with the memories of her travels. Circassian people had a reputation for being untamed, free of mind, and wild. I like to think she taught him the spirit of absolute freedom that can be found in his scientific and intellectual researches, the freedom of a mind that is not bound by prejudices or authority. Interesting hypothesis, and then there's information that seems to confirm it. Leonardo da Vinci, one of the greatest artists ever, and certainly of the Renaissance, Jewish. Who could have known? Well, let's move on here a little bit. You've heard of a town in Ohio called East Palestine. It's famous for a train derailment and release of all kinds of toxic things. And also famous for the disaster being completely ignored by the Biden administration, probably because there weren't very many Democrat voters in this town. There's probably fewer after the experience they just had. But anyway, that's another story. Why is that town named East Palestine? So here we have some commentary on that by a Dr. Raphael Medoff. And this is published in the Jewish Journal. It opens with this statement that reminds that towns such as East Palestine, Ohio, were established by 19th century religious Christian settlers. They chose those names to express their spiritual attachment to the land and the people of the Bible. Okay, a toxic spill, Madoff continues, has drawn the nation's attention to the little town of East Palestine, Ohio, just as another tragedy, the explosion of the space shuttle Columbia in 2003, turned the nation's gaze upon the town of Palestine, Texas, where much of the debris landed. The tragic spotlight now shining on Ohio's East Palestine naturally leaves some people curious as to why it has such an unusual name. The answer is that it's not a very unusual name at all. Elsewhere in Ohio, there are towns named Hebron, Gilboa, Canaan, and Shiloh. Two of them, in fact. There's even a Sodom, which was given its name after a prohibition advocate, disappointed at the small turnout for his lecture in 1840, jokingly compared the locale to that infamous biblical center of sin. Maybe not so jokingly. In Texas, in addition to Palestine or Palestine, there are towns named Hebronville and Joshua. There is a Hebron in North Dakota and a Sinai in South Dakota, a Jerusalem in Arkansas, a Jericho in Vermont, a Bethlehem as well as a Nazareth in Pennsylvania, and a Zion in Maryland. Nearly every state has one or more towns named after biblical sites or individuals. Altogether, there are more than 1,000 biblically named towns from coast to coast. Towns such as East Palestine, Ohio, were established by 19th century religious Christian settlers. They chose those names to express their spiritual attachment to the land and the people of the Bible. When they thought of Palestine, they recalled the Jewish kingdoms and temples of ancient times, as well as the events surrounding the origins of Christianity in the Jewish town of Bethlehem, Beit Lechem in Hebrew. In their prayers, they prayed for the return of the Jews to the Holy Land, which they understood to be inextricably linked to the coming Messianic age. The area that became East Palestine was originally known as Mechanicsburg. There are a number of towns in the U.S. that were originally settled by mechanics of various types. In the case of Ohio, Mechanicsburg was changed in 1836 because, according to an early history of the region, the wife of Dr. Robert Chamberlain desired a more euphonious appellation, a better-sounding name, and desired it be called Palestine. The quiet beauty of the little town and the earnest, virtuous, simple life of its people suggested to her a name recalling holy memories. Since there already was a town named Palestine in the western part of the state, likewise founded by religious Christians who wanted to infuse their town with holy memories, government officials, in assigning the new post office, added the prefix East. That early account of East Palestine's founding was published in 1905, when it was common for a married woman's name to be hidden behind that of her husband. But a historical marker in front of the log house where the Chamberlains once lived tells us that the name of the doctor's wife was Rebecca, an appropriately biblical name for a woman who took the Bible seriously. Not surprisingly, numerous churches quickly sprung up in East Palestine and its environs. Lutheran and Reformed congregations established the Salem Church, choosing a name derived from Jerusalem. Evangelical Lutherans founded the St. Paul's Evangelical Lutheran Church, while Methodists originally held their services in a local school. The separation between church and state still rather fuzzy in those days, before eventually erecting their Methodist Episcopal Church. East Palestine also had a United Presbyterian Church, and later, another house of worship with a biblically inspired name, the Zion Evangelical Lutheran Church. When America's religious Christian settlers thought of the Holy Land, they thought of the Hebrew Bible and the area's 3,000 years of Jewish habitation, not the Quran or the more recently arrived Arab residents of the area. When America's religious Christian settlers thought of the Holy Land, they thought of those things, and they thought of the many Jews who appear in the accounts of the birth of Christianity, including its founder, texts that do not mention any Palestinian Arabs. Certainly, Americans were aware that there were Arabs living in Palestine in the 19th century. Mark Twain, for example, had mentioned them in his account of his visit to the Holy Land. The Innocents Abroad, written in 1869. So had Herman Melville in his famous Clairol, A Poem and the Pilgrimage in the Holy Land, written in 1876. But it was common knowledge that the Arab population of Palestine was relatively small and unsettled, and that the Arab residents of 19th century Palestine regarded themselves as part of southern Syria, not anyone with a separate nationality. H. Allen Tupper, Jr. wrote in the New York Times in 1896, after having ridden on horseback more than 400 miles through Palestine and Syria, that virtually the only local people he encountered were merchantmen with their long camel trains and wild Bedouin tribes that reside in one locality not more than 2 months. Today's residents pronounce East Palestine, Palestine, but the original settlers undoubtedly pronounced it the more common way, because it was the Holy Land with its deep Jewish roots that burned bright in the hearts and prayers of the founders of the many biblically named towns across America. And it is for the same reason that Bible-believing Christians today, probably including more than a few residents of East Palestine, Ohio, constitute one of the major sources of pro-Israel sentiment in the United States. Now you know. Well, those comments, analysis put together by Dr. Medoff, who is the author of more than 20 books about Jewish history and Zionism, including the Historical Dictionary of Zionism, written with Chaim Waxman. East Palestine. Okay. One of many Palestines in the United States. Well, while we're talking about topics like that, let me turn to one by Philologos. Philologos is it's not the given name. It's a trade name taken by a philologist. A philologist is someone who knows about words, and that's why he gives the title Philologos. This is Philologos, means a lover of words. Well, he asks a question. This is titled, the column is titled, Operation Shyster. So he replies that a reader writes to him with a question. I work at a major law firm in Toronto. During a casual conversation, one of my non-Jewish colleagues used the term shyster. Another colleague who is Jewish took exception to the word. It was, he thought, either connected to the character of Shylock in Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, or somehow otherwise freighted with anti-Semitic connotations. We would be grateful if you could shed some light on this issue. Okay, there's the question. Mr. Katz's Jewish colleague can relax. I say Mr. Katz, the reader who wrote that remark's name was Mark Katz. Okay, Mr. Katz's Jewish colleagues can relax. Shyster has historically and etymologically nothing to do with either Shylock or anti-Semitism, and any connection it may have with Jews in some minds is simply a concomitant of the more general association of Jews with a legal profession. But just where the word shyster does come from, on the other hand, is a far from settled question, and one that casts an amusing light on the way unfounded beliefs can win acceptance, with even respected authorities. Thus, my 1961 Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary echoing the scholarly opinion of its day, tells us that shysters were originally named after a non-Jewish New York attorney, Schuster, frequently rebuked in court for pettifoggery. A judgment repeated by my 1969 edition of the American Heritage Dictionary, which slightly modifies it to possibly after Schuster, an unscrupulous 19th century New York lawyer. Ah, his reputation is growing. And yet my 1933 American Heritage recants this derivation and opts instead for shyster, a 19th century British and Australian slang term for a worthless person. And that's from the German word scheißer and ultimately scheiß, which means excrement. And it's a close cognate of the English word shit. Why, one might ask, was Mr. Schuster so rudely discarded? Well, the answer is because he never existed. As was first pointed out in a 1973 article by the noted entomologist David Shulman, Schuster was a pure figment of the imagination to begin with, and first turned up in print half a century after the earliest attested appearance of the word shyster in 1843 in a book about New York City called The American Metropolis, published by the writer Frank Moss in 1897. As quoted by Mr. Shulman, Moss wrote, "The term shyster had its origin in the Essex Market Police Court 50 years ago, when Justice Osborne dispensed justice. There was a Clinton Street lawyer named Schuster, whose practices were so reprehensible and obnoxious to the judge that, when another lawyer played a mean trick, he called it a Schuster practice." Had Mr. Shulman been as credulous or simply as indisposed to exert himself as the rest of us, the myth of Schuster practice would have gone on. Not forever, though. The American slang scholar Gerald Cohen arrived at a similar refutation of it in an article appearing in 1985. But, refusing to take the matter for granted, Mr. Shulman did the obvious thing that no one before him bothered to do. He went and checked the contemporary records, and in them he reports, "I have been unable to find any magistrate named Osborne, or lawyer named Schuster, or Shuster, or like that, in any New York City directories for the period of the 1840s. In fact, David T. Valentine's Manual of the Corporation of the City of New York, for the years 1843 and 1844, lists only Justice Joseph Hoxie for the Essex Market Court and a Barnabas W. Osborne as a clerk in the lower police court. Of course, this does not mean that Moss himself was guilty of deliberately perpetrating a linguistic hoax. In all likelihood, the legendary Schuster, whose name derived from shyster rather than the other way around, was already a mythical figure of courtroom lore when the American Metropolis, whose author assumed these yarns to be true, was written. Where, then, does shyster come from? There remain a number of contending entomologies. Shyster, mentioned above, is probably the most widely accepted, but its credibility suffers from the fact that it never had currency in America, where the word shyster almost certainly first appeared. Its 1843 occurrence was in the American newspaper The Subterranean, while in 1844 it was used by the author George Wilkes in a book called The Mystery of the Tombs, which dealt with the New York prison by that name. Some scholars, H.L. Mencken, may have been the first to have proposed that German scheiß or scheißer evolved independently into shyster in America. Others have suggested that the etymon shy, in its archaic British slang sense of shady or disreputable, the Gaelic word siostir, a vexatious litigant, and Mr. Schulman's own candidate, the Dutch scheistrechter, an arbitrator or umpire. All of these, however, are pure speculation. None would be acceptable by courtroom standards that the pettifogging Schuster was famous for ignoring. Well, a little speculation on Scheister. Not really clear where it came from. Well, we've got a few more articles here. Let's see. Got time for a little more. Here's one. This is our House of Representatives. And it just issued a vote, 401-19. Now, can you imagine getting 401 people in the House of Representatives to agree to something? But they did. 401 out of 420, 19 opposed, 401 voted to honor Israel on its 75th anniversary. Amazing. Okay. I am beyond proud that the United States was the first nation to recognize the nascent state of Israel in 1948, said Representative Brad Schneider, a Democrat from Illinois, who was among those who proposed the resolution. Well, this resolution honoring Israel's 75th year passed in the House of Representatives overwhelmingly this last Tuesday evening after Yom Ha'atzma'ut, which is Israeli Independence Day, had already begun. The shared values of Americans and Israelis have been the bedrock of an extraordinary relationship, strengthening ties among cultural, economic, technological, and security lines, and in so many more ways as well, added Schneider, who was one of four congressional leaders of the Abraham Accords caucus to propose the resolution. The resolution, which was the subject of a contentious question recently at Tuesday's State Department daily press briefing, during which a Foggy Bottom spokesman chastised a reporter for commenting rather than posing questions, but it drew praise from Jewish and pro-Israel organizations. AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, applauded the House for overwhelmingly adopting a resolution recognizing the importance of Israel's 75th anniversary and expressing support both for strengthening the Abraham Accords and expanding U.S.-Israel cooperation. The statement demonstrates that despite the pulls of the most radical, progressive wing of the Democratic Party, the strength of the U.S.-Israel relationship remains overwhelmingly healthy, and that most American members of Congress fully appreciate the profound strength of the U.S.-Israel partnership. So said the Endowment for Middle East Truth, which goes by the name EMET. Opposing the bill, want to know this? Were Representative Thomas Massie, Republican from Kentucky, and 18 Democrats. One Republican opposed it. 18 Democrats opposed it. Representatives Cori Bush from Missouri, Jared Huffman, California, Summer Lee, Pennsylvania, Betty McCollum, Minnesota, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, New York, Ilhan Omar, Minnesota, Mark Pocan, Wisconsin, Ayanna Pressley, Massachusetts, Rashida Tlaib, Michigan, Pamela Jayapal is her name, Washington, Chuy Garcia, Illinois, Andre Carson, Indiana, Raul Grijalva, Arizona, Jamal Bowman, New York, Hank Johnson, Georgia, Nydia Velasquez, New York, Mark DeSaulnier, California, and Della Ramirez from Illinois. Several names there. I'm sure you've heard of them before. Kind of a rogues gallery. But the House did it. 401 voted to honor Israel on their 75th anniversary. Only 19 opposed. Well, there's a little more here. In a statement, a published statement, every Republican governor honored Jewish Heritage Month. They wrote that they affirm the significance of Jewish American contributions throughout United States history. So that's quite a statement. Every Republican governor in the country, 26 of them, signed a statement marking Jewish American Heritage Month, which is May. As public servants and governors, we support and recognize May as Jewish American Heritage Month and call for observance to celebrate the historical, economic, and cultural impact of the Jewish American people who have strengthened our communities and emboldened our nation throughout history, they wrote. They added, they're proud the United States was the first to recognize Israel and noted the unbreakable bond between the two nations, based upon shared values, ultimately leading to prosperous economic, educational, and cultural partnerships. We stand with our constituencies who oppose anti-Semitism, and we affirm the significance of Jewish American contributions throughout United States history. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds and Tennessee Governor Bill Lee reportedly led the drafting and signing of the statement. Both have articulated their support for Jews and Israel publicly on social media in the past. Last month, the Kansas State Legislature passed a resolution to declare May officially Jewish American Heritage Month, a designation that then-President George W. Bush proclaimed nationally in 2006. Well, and one more little story here, maybe a little more. Let's see what we got here. Yeah, a couple little more on the same topic. Here's a Republican vying for Representative Lee's seat blasts her no vote on the Israel resolution. The Congresswoman from Pittsburgh voted against supporting Israel as jury selections are underway in the trial of the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in U.S. history that took place in Philadelphia. 11 people in a synagogue shot in the back. In the midterm election cycle, 2022, millions of pro-Israel dollars poured in trying to keep Pittsburgh area Democrat Summer Lee off Capitol Hill. She prevailed, though, although the situation could become tricky for the Congresswoman in 2024, after she was one of 18 Democrats to vote against a resolution honoring Israel on its 75th birthday and encouraging the expansion of the Abraham Accords, which 401 of her colleagues supported. Lee, whose anti-Israel rhetoric during her campaign has turned to action in Congress, drew the ire Wednesday of a potential opponent who slammed her vote as outrageous and immoral. Does Summer Lee not know why Israel exists? Does she not care? Asked Republican congressional candidate James Hayes. There can be no doubt that Summer Lee stands with anti-Semites like Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib. All pretense has been cast aside by this despicable, hateful vote. Lee, who joined other members of the squad of progressive anti-Israel lawmakers in penning a letter last month to the Biden administration calling on restrictions on aid to Israel, has in the past questioned Israel's right to defend itself. She criticized Israel's reaction to the more than 4,000 rockets launched over 11 days by terror groups based in the Gaza Strip. That was not so long ago, May of 2021, 2 years. Lee's no vote On Tuesday's resolution came in the early days of jury selection for the trial of the suspect in Pittsburgh's Tree of Life congregation mass shooting, noted Hayes, who intends to challenge Lee next year in Pennsylvania's 12th congressional district. To abandon the world's Jews in the face of mounting anti-Semitism is troubling, he wrote. To do so even as jurors are being selected for a trial in the single largest anti-Semitic attack in American history, one that took place in Ms. Lee's district, sends an unmistakable and a frightening message. One more. This is Christian Zionists applaud Israel's 75th anniversary. The Jewish state remains a miracle of God that continues to bless and change the world, said Pastor John Hagee. 75 years since Israel's rebirth as a modern nation, Israel lives. Among the many organizations and foreign nations that congratulated the Jewish state on its 75th anniversary are pro-Israel Christian groups. Today, we celebrate the miraculous rebirth of the Jewish state, tweeted Christians United for Israel, or KUFI. In a video released April 26, which is Yom HaAtzma'ut, Israeli Independence Day, KUFI founder and national director, Pastor John Hagee, said that the five Arab armies that attacked the newly declared Jewish state failed to remember that Israel's defender was God Almighty. The God of Abraham, of Isaac, and Jacob had decreed that a nation shall be born that day. The Jewish state remains a miracle of God that continues to bless and change the world, he added. 75 years since Israel's rebirth as a modern nation, Israel lives. The group, Christians in Defense of Israel, called Israel's modern birth unprecedented. No other nation in history has lost its sovereign existence for nearly 2,000 years, while its people still retained their identity and language all that time, and was then reestablished as a nation in its original homeland, it stated. Matt Staver, the group's chairman, noted that Abraham was 75, the same age Israel is today, when God promised to make him a great nation and showed him the land that his descendants would inherit, present-day Israel. The biblical and historical connection of the land of Israel to the Jewish people is undisputed, said Staver. Well, it's not undisputed, but it certainly was without foundation. Yasser Arafat disputed it, and the Palestinians dispute it. They say Jews have never been in here, and they never have any rights here, and they will never have rights here, and eventually will win. Well, hard to say, but I don't think so. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are just about out of time. So, in leaving, I want to remind you that you are listening to Readings of Interest to the Jewish Community, and I want to thank you for joining me today, and remind you also, my name is Michael Wolin. And in leaving, I'd like to wish all of you a good Shabbos, Shabbat Shalom, and Shavua Tov. Have a good week.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.